Smile and wave.
Smile and wave, smile and wave. I'm quite relaxed about Egypt, and Egypt's relaxed about me.
Are you relaxed about this, motherfucker?
Yeah.
Please note that the following program includes adult themes and language. You're listening to the weekly show on Discourse.
Oh, yeah, I'm back.
Episode 16. Relax on this, Mr. Key. With Morgan and Ben.
Yes, we're back, Benjamin Gracewood from the internet.
Yes, we're back, and I'm remote again, way out in Matiaratu.
Vague, distant.
Yes, and how are you this week?
I'm still excited about how great last week's show was.
It was
I had
fantastic.
Such incredible feedback on that show.
Great feedback, mostly due to Lance Wiggs. We'll have to have him back on.
Mostly. Entirely. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, so what's news this week with you?
Oh, so many things. There's a whole lot of exciting stuff going on. For instance, Windows Phone 7 is turns into a lead balloon in the market.
We'll have to discuss that one later on.
You know what else has happened?
John Key announced he was going to...
He's finally like shown his stripes.
Yes, he would like to consider selling some assets. And as always with things like this on Discourse, we like to... pretend we know something, but we don't. So we get the people on who do know something about this. So we have a couple of guests on Skype as well.
I don't even pretend to know.
Don't you? I do.
No, I read headlines. I don't read body copy. I form my opinions based on sound bites.
I guess you could say a representative of either side of the debate on this topic.
Are we going to go on national radio from the left and from the right?
Well, from one side, you make up your minds. We've got Keith Ng of Public Address and self-proclaimed Nerdcenary for Hire.
We've got a guest on Discourse.
Welcome, Keith.
G'day, Ben.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. And from some other side, we've got David Farrar from KiwiBlog, which is, I mean, I'm sure everyone knows David. KiwiBlog is, I think, it must be the largest blog in New Zealand by probably quite a margin, right?
Yeah, for better or worse, it attracts lots of comments.
Yeah.
Good evening to everyone.
We've got a guest on Discourse.
Yeah, thank you for joining us, David.
Yeah. So, Morgan, you had a summary on this, I believe.
This isn't my words. This is from Bomber Bradbury's blog. So, I mean, he's from his own side. So let me just quote this. Key has said mum and dad invested so often he sounds like a parrot with a cracker. Or should that be a cracker with a parrot? This is spin. Once sold to mum and dad investors, they are free to sell to whom they like. And as the Treasury papers point out, they'll end up in the hands of overseas investors. Bill English couldn't justify why he wouldn't sell the remaining 51% on Radio NZ on Friday. And if John Key says we need the money now, what will change in 10 months' time when he needs more money? John Key lied to our faces about not raising GST. Why believe him now?
Interesting. So, yeah, what's my other point on that was that back in December, John Key said that government debt was no problem whatsoever. He was totally happy with it at 20% of GDP and topping out at 28%. So why has he changed his tune? Why all the drama? And why is the number suddenly 85%, which is debt and private GDP? So, yeah, any idea on that? Are the numbers right, Keith?
Sure, the numbers are right, but the problem that I really have with the way this issue has been discussed is that selling assets doesn't address our public debt issue. It's not that we don't have a public debt issue or we don't have a private debt issue, it's that the two things are completely separate. Selling assets, sure, you actually get some cash from it and you can use it to pay off debt, but the reason why debt is a problem in the first place is because we have to pay interest to creditors overseas. And because we have this constant flow of money going out, that's why it's drained on the economy. But if we sell assets to pay off debt, then we've lost an income as well. So we're when you actually balance out the equation, we're no better off. It doesn't matter who we sell the asset to. It could be the New Zealanders, it could be the foreigners, but it's still, at the end of the day, we don't actually reduce our total the debt problem isn't actually reduced.
So the amount of debt that we reduce doesn't reduce our payments significantly, but it reduces our income significantly because we're selling a major part of our assets. Would you say that?
And because
both sides are equal. Right. You know, you're actually reducing debt on one side, so you're reducing the amount of interest payments overseas.
Yep.
But then on the other hand, you're reducing the amount of income from the asset coming in. So ultimately, no credit agency is going to go, hey, you're doing great. You don't have a mortgage anymore, but you've sold your house.
So Dave,
they're going to look at both.
Yeah, David, the comment I hear is that if you talk to Treasury, they will recommend that. Is that true?
Oh, look, Treasury is quite funny, actually, for the government. We're looking at doing this, but we'll only do it if Treasury recommends we do it. And as I think Vernon Smallcroke had asking Treasury for should we sell assets is like asking a local boy, would they like a bigger ice cream? So too much doubt over what the Treasury advice would be. What Keith has said is that if you sell half a power company, that will reduce your debt, but then you only get half as many dividends. And Keith is right in that, but some context I want to put around this is I'll do a bit of an analogy to, say, the Terry Serapisos empire. Yep. And what we've got at the moment is the government has actually been put on credit warning by Standards and Poor's. That means there's a very real chance that they are going to give us a credit downgrade. And that's one of the rare things in politics or economics which is universally bad, because it increases the cost of borrowing, not just for the government, but pretty much around New Zealand.
Isn't there?
Yeah, but when you've got your banker saying, hey, we're a bit worried about your level of borrowing and debt. If you take the analogy to the Serapisos, he is, because he's got bankers coming after him, selling some of his buildings, even though they are making money, because the way you reassure them is you actually do get your debt down. It's just like if you have 9 apartment buildings and you've got problems with debt, yes, you may sell 1 or 2. When it comes to the power companies, you know, I see it as a matter of, is it strategically important for New Zealand to own 100% of these power companies? If it was Transpower, which is the national grid, then I think you would say yes. But these are commercially competitive companies, so taking a lesser shareholding in them I don't think is a bad thing, because I think one of the things we have to be a bit careful about is not to say that we should only own these SOEs 100% as a way to make money. If our sole reason for owning an SOE is because it's a good investment, well, actually, what we should then just do is give them all over to the superannuation fund and let the professional fund managers there decide, do they get the best return from owning 100% of Mighty River Power, or would they be better buying some more telecom shares?
There are a couple of things here. I just want to jump in. David talked about the credit report, the Standards and Poor credit report that was issued last December. And it doesn't actually say that the public debt is the issue. It says that our net debt is the issue. And it says our net debt is the issue because of our external position, because of the fact that, like what I was saying before, that we actually have to constantly push out money to pay international lenders because of our borrowing. And again, I come back to this point that selling assets doesn't actually address that problem. It only puts down one side of the ledger, but then it puts the problem onto the other side of the ledger.
I'd like to also ask about that separation of private and public debt, because John Key specifically said there was no issue with public debt in December. And the only thing that selling assets does is reduce public debt, does it not? I mean, how does it reduce private debt?
You're right, it doesn't. And the figures we talked about earlier, 85% is the total debt of New Zealand, public and private combined, as a percent of GDP. And that's one of the highest in the world. The public component of it's around 20%. That, though, is forecast to rise massively over the next few years until we can get back in surplus. And why there has been a change in the last few months is that the accounts of the Crown have deteriorated somewhat over that time, with the fact that we almost ended up in a double dip recession again.
Oh, that bloody Barack Obama. I bet it's his fault.
Absolutely. Look, I actually agree with David here. I agree with... I'm trying to agree with you here, David. Give me... You're absolutely right that we have a fiscal problem. Long term, we actually have to cut spending or raise taxes or do something to turn that around. But what I'm saying is that this whole week, the way we've been talking about asset sale as a way of turning that around is a lie. The only reason why we're talking about selling assets and our long-term fiscal problems together in the same sentence is because John Key's spin doctor decided it would be a great idea to put those two things in the same speech. If you actually think about it carefully, it doesn't. They don't actually gel. The fact that we're selling our assets doesn't mean that we won't have a deficit in the future. Not at all.
It seems to me to be a really short-term approach to it. And I'm wondering, wouldn't we be better off to make, like you say, big changes in terms of reducing private debt, say, you know, random examples here, compulsory KiwiSaver and, you know, more consumption tax. I'm not saying, I don't know whether that's good or bad, but it stops people buying stuff. Isn't that a bit of a long-term approach?
This actually came out today with a number of recommendations to increase private savings, which will reduce private debt. And one of them is to almost effectively make KiwiSaver compulsory. I don't want to concede to Keith. Well, Keith is, let's not pretend that the only reason for doing this is about the debt reduction, because there's many other reasons.
Ideology.
Be a good idea. And it's not going to make a huge difference. But credit companies don't just look at your net worth. They do actually look at gross debt as well as net debt. Just because we have brought things with that debt doesn't mean that they automatically think, oh, that's okay then. So there is actually value in reducing gross debt. Net debt and net worth are more important to a country, but when the credit rating companies are a bit nervous, I think it isn't a bad idea to be able to say, rather than borrow $33 billion for the next 5 years of assets that we need to acquire or build, we'll actually borrow a bit less than that by selling some shares in companies where we don't really need to own 100% of them.
Well, the savings working group report said pretty much the same thing. It devoted three paragraphs to asset sales. And what it said was that it won't actually make a dent on our liability. So what they were saying before, that it won't actually have an impact on our net position. But what it will have is, what it will do is send a signal to the market, which, I mean, essentially what the savings working group was saying was that selling assets won't do a great deal to actually give us more money, but it will send a signal to the market, which, David, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of what you're saying as well, that it sends a signal to the creditors, credit rating agencies, so that we won't get this downgrade, right? Not a trick question.
I'm just saying, look, we are serious about not letting gross debt get too high. Also, it does tie into some of the other stuff about the savings working groups, where there have been complaints about lack of quality investments in New Zealand. And again, I don't think that's a sole rationale that you sell SOEs just because the share market's about flat. But I think you can have a recognition that those sort of assets probably would be quite popular as things to invest in.
That's a trap right there. can I explain why? If you're saying that the SOEs are actually really good assets, that they're really good things to invest in, and you're saying that the government should get rid of them and sell them off on the market so that private investors can invest in them, who exactly are the private investors is going to be? It's going to be people who actually have money to buy these shares. And so what you're saying is that the government should get rid of this really good assets and allow people with money to invest, i.e. people who are reasonably well off, to actually benefit from it. So you're saying it's a wealth transfer. So again, it's sure there might be, it might be good for the stock market, but what is something good for the stock market good for?
All right, David, can you respond? Sorry, David, we had a little bit of overtalk there, and Skype doesn't do very well with that.
I was just saying that anyone who's in KiwiSaver, which is most New Zealand now, would benefit from being able to buy into the SOEs, because their KiwiSaver funds, I think, are highly likely to. So it's not just those who are better off.
Sure, KiwiSaver, definitely.
I have a totally different tangent. You know, we've got both views, and it's all. It feels very dogmatic and very ideological. But didn't the government changed the electricity legislation sort of mid to late last year prior to the S&P report to relax pricing rules. Am I wrong on that?
Sorry, I don't really know much about that particular piece of legislation.
Yeah, I might have to look it up, so I should have researched beforehand.
All right, and just I've just been trying to fact check something that David said about debt. In terms of public debt, New Zealand does really extraordinarily well. In terms of external debt, now unfortunately these figures are from 2009. We don't do nearly as well.
But I think we're still well below Greece and that sort of stuff, are we not? Or I mean, I guess we don't want to be anywhere near Greece, but.
Oh, we are very, very far away from Greece on this table.
The other thing I want to know, and I kind of, because I was too young at the time, is what did the last sell-off get us? Was it the same situation that it was a
telecom?
Well, was it a requirement for us to get our asses out of a jam, like the Sarah Pesos example, or was it done for, you know, share market reasons? And what did we get out of it? Do you know, David?
Yeah, the last assets sold were Auckland International Airport by Winston Peters, ironically, and Kennedy, which happened just after his time in government. And both of those were more predated on, and to some degree this should be the bigger debate, is there a need for the state to own these assets? There's some assets like roads and hospitals that you definitely want the government owning. There's a legitimate debate about, does the government need to own power companies? And what we've actually seen is one of four power companies has been sold, is in the private sector. And I don't actually see a lot of difference between that power company, Contact Power, and Mighty River Power and Meridian Energy. And in fact, I suspect most of their customers don't see much difference either. So, to a degree, the debate we should be having isn't just...
Oh, is that the sound of David's connection going away? Sorry, David.
Yep.
We just lost you there for 5 or 10 seconds. The Skype connection to sunny Wellington isn't going very well for us at the moment.
Well, blame my ISP.
But I think I got the gist of what you were saying was the point of, should the government own assets that are non...
Strategic,
or just basically would perform the same in private hands. It's an interesting one to me, because to me as a investor, I'm an incredibly conservative investor, and I would tend to go for things like bonds and power companies. And I would think as the archetypal long term investor, isn't it in the government's best interest to invest in these things? Massively, you know, long term investments that require long term thinking. Because the private sector just doesn't do that.
If the rationale is just to get good returns, then the superannuation fund could decide to invest in them, because they've actually got the task of taking money, future superannuation, and deciding what goes in there. But I think you have to be careful about saying these are sort of safe, risk-free, long-term investments, because if they're government-owned, you may end up owning things you don't want. If I take the example of Auckland International Airport, people could have a legitimate view that that should be owned. But Auckland Airport has actually brought an airport in Brisbane. Now, does the New Zealand taxpayer really want to be owning airports in Queensland? In fact, the Auckland...
Not if it's underwater.
It's quite possible. Yeah, well, yes, it's
now. Too soon.
It's hey, now it's a port as well.
Power companies may want to merge with an Australian company and start buying some power stations in Australia if they think that fits their strategic plan. So we have to be a bit careful about assumptions.
That's what China does, isn't it? I mean, China will invest overseas quite happily because it guarantees their ongoing growth and income. Shouldn't we do the same?
China's...
Well, China's situation is that they've got more capital than they've got opportunities locally, so that's why a lot of their money goes overseas. But it does tie into this strange mentality we have in New Zealand that we're trying to cut both sides, that we're worried about foreign investors investing in our local economy, because then the profits from those companies would go overseas, which, you know, is perfectly legitimate. But then on the other hand, we're going, well, we don't want New Zealand capital to go overseas to invest in overseas companies so that we could get their profits back into New Zealand.
Yeah. Oh, I want that.
Because apparently we need more capital. So we're kind of trying to keep both sides, but it doesn't really make sense. The bottom line is that we need to invest more, and it doesn't really matter whether we invest in New Zealand or in overseas, as long as we're investing and making money, and that money is coming back. I mean, that's the key thing.
For the private sector, I am very happy for as much foreign investment in New Zealand as possible, because I think it's very good for New Zealand, and we'd have a lot less jobs if we didn't have it. Likewise, I think it's great when New Zealand companies do expand to Australia, the world, and buy things up. The point I was making is when it's a government-owned company and when it's taxpayers being asked to put capital into that company and take the risk, that's where I think it's getting inappropriate. I think... Yeah.
If you look at something like the Cullen Fund,
it's a far better place to make those judgments about risk.
Well, if government has money...
I have to interject there. The private sector has been pretty fucking atrocious at assessing risk in the last 3 or 4 years, surely. Sorry.
It's very easy when we see high-profile companies like finance companies fail to say, oh, private sector's crap. But if you look over the post-World War II period... I think there is a lot of evidence that the private sector has done very, very well at creating a huge amount of wealth. And yes, we've had the global recession, but again, a one-year recession doesn't actually negate 50 years of private sector prosperity. And when you look at, we talk about China and other countries, their growth, which is partly keeping the world afloat, has come from opening up and allowing the private sector in.
Well, can I bring this back to this idea of, the overarching idea here is, should government actually hold that much assets? What David is suggesting is that if the government shouldn't invest in various profit-making activities, that it shouldn't be in business, essentially, then the government can't really store any assets, that it can't keep a whole lot of money, because otherwise it wouldn't be doing anything with it. It would be a waste, right? So... the problem that we have is that we're facing an aging population that if we don't save now, if we don't stock up either in cash or in assets, and if we have cash, we have to invest them in assets, then we are really facing a future where we will have to get that money, get the operating costs that we need in the future out of future generations of taxpayers, i.e. the people that are either young or in their working prime today. And that's fundamentally the issue, that if National starts selling off our assets, starts reducing the amount of assets that the government holds, then we're in an even worse position to deal with all that stuff about the aging population that we were talking about before.
That was my gut feel as well, Keith, is if you sell, $5 billion of $10 billion, $10 billion worth of electricity companies, you sell $5 billion of that and turn it into cash, that's $5 billion less of income generating assets.
Yeah, that money is going to go into capital expenditure and operating expenditure that we're using today. And then in 5, 10, 20 years' time, we're going to go, oh, man, we don't really have enough cash. We need to get this out of the current population.
And I understand David's point that we need to do this to get over an impending hump. And we don't want to be downgraded, because that makes our position even worse in terms of interest. So what's the alternative?
Seriously, the hump is not now. We are not at the hump. The hump is really, really fucking big, and it's going to come when the aging population really hits for real. To actually consider us to be in, like, the situation that we're in now is not the worst of it. One of the things that's actually the thing that didn't get mentioned much in Key's speech was he said that. Well, he signaled that the operating, the future operating allowance was going to get slashed again. It sounds really dry. It sounds like some sort of accounting thing. But what it actually means is that every year we're going to be spending $300 million less than what we otherwise would have. And it's cumulative. So it's this year we're going to be spending $300 million less, and then another $300 million, and then another $300 million less. The cumulative effect of it is huge. That what we're saying is that, Bernard Hickey looked at this last year after the last budget, and what we were actually looking at was, Treasury did the same analysis, that our total public sector spending per person is going to keep going down for a very long time. And what John Key has just done is to decrease that even further. And the point is, it's not that this government hasn't actually cut anything. It's just said future governments are going to have to cut a heck of a lot, and they're going to have to cut it every single year. It kind of looks amazing on the books right now that, oh my God, we just made $40 billion of debt disappear in the distant future, but we haven't actually lost anything. We haven't actually felt.
It sounds like backwards Enron to me.
No.
It's New Year's resolution.
Sorry, David. I'm aware David's having a harder time to get through his Skype. So, David, what were you going to say?
There's a go. What it really is fiscal discipline. The reality is the spending has got to a point where it well exceeds, whether or not you had tax cuts, what the government is earning. And unless you want to radically increase taxes, you do need to have spending under control. And things like, you know, in the news today was about early childhood education cuts. What hasn't been mentioned so much is ECE spending has tripled in 5 years, and the actual cuts are still $100 million more than budgeted. It's just that the blowout's been so large that it would have increased even further without these restrictions. So what the government said is, we're not going to keep growing spending where things like ECE triple in 5 years. We're going to have to live within our dime until the economy's growing enough, that the tax take's growing enough, that we're basically back in surplus.
I don't have a problem with the government saying that it has to keep its spending in line with whatever its income. But my problem is that it's saying that future governments have to tighten its belt. And that's the problem is that it's keeping on saying, oh, future governments will do it, future governments will do it. It's like New Year's resolution that says, well, next month I'm going to lose 10 pounds. Yeah, and the month after that I'm going to lose 10 pounds.
Well, governments always do that, don't they? They always basically blame the previous one, then leave the shit for the next one.
But I think it's important to note, what Keith's talking about is the contingency for future spending, where they say, we assume next year the government will spend X more than the year before. And there's no magic figure of what this should be. Back in the 90s, the budget figure was $600 million. And actually people were quite happy with that the government would spend an extra $600 million each year, you know, for nice things. Under Labor, that blew out to eventually an extra $1.8 billion a year. Now, this government reduced it to 1.1 and is now saying it will drop back to 0.8. But that's still growth, even though it's not growth per capita, and it's still higher than it was in the 90s. So I don't think we can say what Labor did, $1.7 billion extra per year, was the right amount.
But isn't this just the natural progression in terms of the economic cycle as well? So Labor had boom years. They were allowed to, well, you know, they had the ability to be profligate. National is in a tighter cycle, so they have to reduce that naturally. But does that entail selling off debt? And you know, again, cutting tax while at the same time saying we can't spend as much seems like a bit of a, I don't know what the right word for it is, but it seems a bit crazy, really. It's like me saying, I don't know. I haven't got a good analogy.
The tax cuts have largely been the full 4 years, because they got rid of some KiwiSaver subsidies and they cancelled 2 years of the tax cuts plus the GST increase. Over the next 3 years, the tax cuts package, including the reduction in spending, actually will reduce government debt by around $3 billion.
I can't see how that works, but I guess you're saying that GST is going to make it for more of it.
It reduces debt because the first round of tax cuts, they cut spending to match the tax cuts, which was the KiwiSaver subsidies.
Okay, so again, they've taken away from the private debt problem that we have and made it worse. And I don't know. I mean, I'm having trouble here. I mean, I understand that no one's perfect, but it just seems like a number of decisions just seem irrational in the face of the requirement to reduce debt.
Can I tell you where the money comes from? There's a $1.08 billion line in the last budget. That's macroeconomic adjustment for macroeconomic effects. What that actually means is it's code for because we cut taxes, therefore we assume that growth is going to pick up, and therefore this tax cut was partially free. So, you know, something that actually cost a significant amount of money in the books, half the cost, $1 billion of the cost, disappeared because they assume that a certain thing is going to flow through.
So happening instead is people are basically saving that extra money, aren't they?
No, sorry. Here's the genius of it. Here's the genius of macroeconomics. That if revenue goes up, if that $1.1 billion actually does happen, that revenue goes up, then they'll take credit for it. They'll go, well, yeah, because of the tax cut, therefore our revenue went up. If that revenue doesn't go up, then, well, it's probably other factors. It could be the global economy. It could be China. It could be America. But that $1.1 billion did come, but it's just something else took away $1.1 billion. So it's one of these things where they can't actually get it wrong. They just said, well, we made a $2 billion tax cut or whatever it was, and $1 billion of it was funded from this magical macroeconomic effect, and you can't prove me wrong.
So it sounds like, I mean, regardless of which way you look at it, it all comes down to politics. whichever way your dogma swings.
Well, no, I think there is. You call it politics, but it's kind of assumptions about the economy. It's assumptions that tax cuts are good for growth. It's assumptions that privatization is good for companies, and these are assumptions that are not particularly well grounded in fact. Whether they happen or not. I mean, I have some sympathy for those ideas. I think they might be true, but we really are betting quite a lot on those ideas, and that's sort of ideological bent that we're talking about.
So any closing comments from you? We'll give you clear air for a while to say anything you want.
Just that Keith has put forward two propositions, one being that there is a belief that tax cuts lead to high economic growth, and I think on that one there actually is considerable evidence because there's been studies done not of one country over 1 year, like in that year you cut taxes, did the economy boom, but all OECD countries over 40 years since World War II, and there's pretty clear correlation that those which are low-tax economies have had much higher economic growth. Really the challenge is, yes, cutting taxes does help grow the economy, but if you cut them too much, you can't afford to pay for the things that people like the government to pay for, and that really comes to the ultimate of the political versus economic debates, is growing the economy versus what you can afford. More controversial is whether privatisation leads to better managed companies. I think, again, when you look at the entire private sector versus the entire history of the public sector, it does, but that doesn't mean every company run by the private sector will be good and that every company run by the public sector will be bad, because clearly companies like New Zealand Post are doing very well government-owned. Mm.
Thanks, David. That's really well put. Just one final thing before you go. It's a bit cheeky, but I read in your comments once that people say you're employed by the National Party. Is this true?
No longer... Thank God. Just to put in context, I worked for them for 8 years in Parliament. I run a polling company. We have a number of clients, etc., including a large political party. I can't actually name my clients and leave people to guess who they may or may not be.
Excellent.
But the quite interesting thing is I think I've actually managed to slag off on my blog every single one of my clients at some stage.
That's cool. We'll ask the same thing of Keith as well. But thank you so much for your time, David. Really appreciate it. And we've loved having you. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us. Keith, before you go, maybe we can do an Urban Dictionary Word of the Week.
Urban Dictionary Word of the Week.
And your word, Keith, is ignoranus.
Ignoranus?
Yeah.
Can you use that in the sentence for me?
No.
No, that's part of the joy of
Okay. Oh, can you at least... ignoranus.
Yeah.
Okay. Someone who pulls shit out of their ass and pretends they know what they're talking about. That's someone who pulls shit out of their ass.
So, such a good guess.
That sounds obvious, doesn't it? I mean, ignoranus.
I mean, if it's the other way around, if it's going back in, it doesn't really make much sense at all. So it has to be pulling out.
Mm. Ben?
I'm going to go dirty on this one because, again, I think that that Morgan is needing to go that way. I'm going to say it's someone who doesn't consider the anus when pleasuring their partner. So they ignore the anus.
Oh
God! I don't think you weren't low enough in the gutter there, Keith.
Well, I do keep remembering a line from Entourage, one of the filthier lines, in fact. The pussy is now my third favorite hole. that was what one of the characters said. I just want to disown that comment. That was a quote from a different character.
Entourage has some fantastic quotes. Yes.
Now, I will tell you, this has had 4,059 upvotes, 324 downvotes. It was added in 2003, so it's an old one. The definition, according to Urban Dictionary, is a person who is not only ignorant, but also an asshole.
Close, but no cigar.
Ignoranus. I got you! Once again, I'm invincible!
Thank you very much. With that, I will take me in my ass and... Go.
Thanks, Keith. Have a wonderful
night. Neither ignorant nor an asshole. Thank you so much for joining us, Keith.
Thank you very much. See ya.
Bye-bye.
See
ya. You're listening to Discourse.
Alone at last, Ben. Let's have a little kiss.
it's a relief. We can talk.
We can speak freely.
I felt like I had to hold back a lot during that whole thing. I don't know why.
I felt like I had to hold back a lot because I was out of my depth. Talking to actual pundits.
I think those guys did well.
Yeah,
doing with each other.
Yeah, they were wonderful. I hope that the listeners enjoyed it. Did you enjoy it, listeners? Did you enjoy it? Tell us on Twitter. Say, wow, that show was great. You should listen to Discourse. Tell your friends that the show sometimes is insane and sometimes it's wonderful. And this time, listeners, my beloved listeners, I haven't had any caffeine. That's probably why things haven't gone insane yet. And also, let's fix that. Also, you'll note that I'm trying to play it quite clean this week because last week, I believe it was Chris Keel who described us as the swearing show.
Well, hey, Chris Keel is notoriously straight-laced, so I don't think we have to worry about that.
I'm not worried, but I just, you know, I don't want to be cubbyholed by my swearing. I would like to be cubbyholed as funny, not as rude. Well, maybe rudely funny.
So what I think we should do news, and then we will put it. One of those news items is, of course, Egypt, which we can't really not talk about. It's so fucking
absolutely
fucked.
Yeah.
But again, continuing our regular theme of only talking to people who know about shit.
Yeah.
We might talk to it. Well, we will talk to an Egyptian later on in the show.
So. I was going to say we've got a horse's mouth, but instead, I will wonder if it's appropriate to say we've got a camel's mouth. Is that weird? Is that really weird to say?
Well, the thing is, we have a lot of Arabs, Middle Easterns. I don't know what the right term for these guys are. You know, Egypt through Iraq, Iran, Jordan. A lot of guys are at work from that area, mm-hmm. And I just call them the Arab Mafia because they all know each other and they all help each other out, and they don't seem to mind. So that's all good.
Right. Okay. So let's get on to the news. Now here I've got. I love this story because it's going to upset you a little bit. It's going to upset all the Apple weenuses as well. So Android started much later than Apple, kicking their ass now. They've had, now in what period is this growth? It says 615% growth. Is that in a quarter or in a year? I think that's 2010.
Yeah, I think so.
2010, Google's Android platform, 615% growth. Apple, astonishing growth at 85%. Microsoft, minus 20.3%.
I think that's probably everyone's talking about the Android news. I think that Microsoft news is pretty sad. So what it's saying is that...
Microsoft's Ben Gracewood.
Yeah, no, I've got nothing to do with Microsoft.
Ben Gracewood, MVP.
They explicitly say in the MVP description is they're valued for their independent opinion. Yeah. So on that note, what's happened is obviously Windows Phone 7 has cannibalized Windows Mobile, which they expected to happen, but there hasn't been the same conversion. So less people are buying Windows Phone 7 than were buying Windows Mobile before, which is terrible.
That's right. I think they cannibalized themselves. And this looks especially bad because everyone else went up. Even RIM went up 36%. Nokia up 30%. Others, quote others, whatever that means, up 64%. Microsoft, the only player which is down.
Yeah, it's pretty, pretty shocking. And all I can imagine is that the only the Windows mobile stuff is probably people buying those rugged symbol devices and courier, things that couriers use.
Yeah.
And the Windows Phone things, a fraction of that, 2 million licenses they've shipped. Mm. So yeah, but so what
2 million.
You're saying, Android is now the biggest smartphone in the world?
Did you say Microsoft have shipped 2 million?
The number they're claiming.
Oh, but they only had maybe half a quarter, didn't they?
No, yeah, they've sold 2 million licenses into the channel. So that means that, so if HTC is going to make a million devices, they'll buy a million licenses. Doesn't mean they've sold them yet.
Right.
So it's even worse than that. But yeah, you're true. They only launched halfway through the quarter, which is one redeeming factor.
According to this report, there have been 32.9 million Android devices sold in the last quarter of last year.
It's pretty unbelievable, eh?
Yeah, pretty amazing. And Nokia are second with their Symbian devices at 31 million. So very, very close behind.
Mm. Do you think that's activations? Because Google can report people who've activated.
That's always been a bit of a minefield to get into that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. This could be trickery. This could be warehouses full of devices.
But I doubt, they're definitely selling a shit ton.
For instance, there was talk of the Galaxy Tab. They said 2 million devices sold, but that was actually sold into the channel. That's not necessarily devices sold to punters.
Isn't it funny that people that have an interest in propping up their numbers talk about, oh, we actually made this many of them.
Yeah.
I don't care if they're sitting in a warehouse somewhere.
Ben, but I just manufactured 45 billion sperm, but I've got no babies. If you don't have an egg, it doesn't matter how many sperms you've got.
But yeah, I do think that that those Android numbers are kosher because it's just unbelievably good.
Yeah.
But
and you do see them around.
Really. The only but you can put on it is if you say, look, you can't compare an Android 1.5 tiny little device to an iPhone or to a Windows phone.
Yeah.
So there is that's some fraction. The same thing with Symbian as well. So there's some fraction of that 33 million which are, I guess,
pieces of shit.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, the other way around. There's some fraction of that, a good fraction, which is still amazing, which are good phones.
Yeah, no doubt. I would say that Apple's iPhones and iPads are still the best devices. I'd say they're still the best devices by some margin, but I would say that it is inevitable.
It also depends on your measure of best, because this is what I say to everyone. I mean, I'm going to be, I'm changing my tune.
Yeah.
But if your overarching philosophy is bloody, Richard Stallman, everything must be open, then that's Android is the best phone for you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, speaking of open and Android being based on Linux, oh, that is so tenuous. Keith was actually our first ever guest using Linux, as far as I'm aware.
Wow, I wonder what we should do a graph.
And it sounded clean, his audio, didn't it?
That sounded lovely. We should do a graph of I'm pretty sure David's a Windows user. I think I've seen him use his Windows laptop around.
Right. I think my prejudice is that it's Apple's tend to sound better. I think that they generally have better onboard sound.
Well, you know exactly what you're getting as well.
So. Because the HP are paying 2 cents for the sound chip, right?
Yeah. But Apple will be paying 3 cents, but they will be getting the one that they want.
They will have designed it themselves.
Yeah.
And they will have fabbed it probably in their own factories. This is a rat hole. Next story. Oh, have we finished
with
that?
No, there's one other point to that. Yep. Google hiring Android developers because they closed the apps gap.
Yeah, that's
What's
right.
What's that one?
Wow, it's an interesting question, is it? And actually next week, I'm not going to have any Android developers on. Next week is going to be, it's shaping up to be a bit of an iPhone, iPad developer episode. We're going to have, as far as I'm aware, probably the three kind of most rock star iOS developers in New Zealand.
Shit, and I'm going to be away.
You're going to be away. We're going to have Carl Von Rando co-hosting the show.
Oh,
yep, mobile photos and, Camera Plus, and you know, a whole lot of other really great apps,
real
and the Real Estate ONZ app. A lot of really amazing apps. We're also going to have Polar Bear Farm. We're going to have Leighton on.
He's never short of an opinion.
Never short of an opinion. And we're going to have Magic Dave on.
What a bloody great show.
Isn't it?
You fuck.
I know. When the cat's away, the mice will play, Ben. Very sorry. And I guess we're not going to have... I'll ask them what they think Android can do to sort of catch up in the apps. I think the number one thing that Android has to do, as this is kind of a, you know, obviously a very lay opinion, is sort out their bloody store.
Sort out the fucking pirates, sort out the the unlocks, all that stuff.
Yeah. And of course, the fragmentation is a huge problem as well. Mm. But as we saw, actually, with some stats that we saw a week or two ago, fragmentation not necessarily as big a problem as we may have thought.
I dug into that, though, because what they were saying
is that there are a lot of devices. About 80% were 2.1 up.
Yeah, but then I asked around the Android developers that I knew, and they said the difference between 2.1 and 2.3 is like the difference between iPhone 3 and 4 from a developer perspective. Right. There's a huge difference. There's a massive amount of new APIs. Again, I could be talking my ass, but that's what I've heard.
And we're going to have Android 3 possibly within a couple of weeks, right?
Yep.
So then the picture will look even more murky. So it's,
yes,
and
while we're down this rat hole, just one more thing, because I imagine people are getting bored. One more thing is
is
the weird, weird, weird world of Nokia.
Yeah.
And Stephen Elop, former senior employee of Microsoft, I don't know who he was, he's now the CEO of Nokia.
Yeah, I've heard something about this.
There was an earnings call, and he gave this cryptic message. I'll read it to you and see if you can decode it. He said, in addition to great device experiences, we must build, capitalize, and or join a competitive ecosystem. The ecosystem approach we select must be comprehensive and cover a wide range of utilities and services that customers expect today and anticipate in the future.
I mean, so that's got to be Android.
Yeah, breaking it down. What's an ecosystem? That could be, you know, Facebook. But then he says competitive ecosystem. Yeah, yeah. So it definitely means another OS.
Yeah. And that can't be Windows Phone 7. And it's not going to be iOS. So what does that leave?
It can't be iOS. Well, when you say it can't be Windows Phone 7, it would be incredibly unlikely. It would be a huge move. The only thing I've heard on that is I heard someone, I think it was on This Week in Tech, saying that Stephen Elop, you know, he's worked for Microsoft for years. If he puts Nokia on Android, he's effectively putting the nail in Windows Phone 7's coffin.
Right.
Would you do that?
Especially as someone who is obviously a Microsoft old boy.
Would you do it? You would, I suppose, if you genuinely think it's the best thing for the company. And is Android the best thing for Nokia? I guess they could come out and say we have the best Android device.
What is closer to Symbian, Phone 7 or Android?
Android.
It's got to be, doesn't it?
Yeah, the only other thing I can think about, again, I mean, I have to admit I'm clutching at straws, but... you can imagine Microsoft, if they go to Nokia and say Windows Phone 7 is free for you guys, because you know other people had to pay a certain, a couple of bucks a phone or whatever, free for you guys, because they know they're going to get out of it. You know, if they can get Windows Phone 7 off the ground, it's a big win for them.
Mm.
And Nokia would look at it and say, you know? I mean, if they look at it from a completely dispassionate view, and again, I have to keep on saying this, you put down iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Android side by side, and just scroll around the thing, ignoring the feature set, the flow of the UI. In my mind, iPhone and Windows Phone 7 are closer than Android.
Right.
So if you're going to hand on heart say what is the nicest user experience, assuming that eventually all of them will get to the same level of functionality, you're not going to get iOS, but you can get your hands on Windows Phone 7. So when you think of it that way, there's a chance.
are there a lot of developers in Windows Phone 7?
Yep.
Compared to Android?
It's much more locked down. There's less risk of this whole piracy, and fucked up App Store.
End users probably don't care about piracy. They do care about App Store.
Yeah.
I think that App Store is a big, how to acquire apps is a big problem. Have you heard anything about what Amazon are doing? I know that there were rumors that they were going to start their own App Store.
I haven't heard any more on that. Just they said they were going to.
I think that's going to come, and that could be a game changer. We'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, they sell. It is a rat hole. But I mean, they sell a ton of ebooks. They sell now Amazon. I think sometime last year, Amazon last year sometime, their ebook sales for Kindle surpassed their hardcover sales. They now say that their ebook sales have also surpassed their paperback sales.
Fuck me.
Yep, serious stuff.
That's a shit. That's a lot of books. Sorry, you were going to do a clean show.
I am doing a clean show. I don't require that you change your behavior at all, Ben. Just as, I mean, Keith dropped a little quiet F-bomb of his own. I am only modifying my own behavior. No one else's. Actually, and speaking of more rat holes, rat hole, it's rat hole day on Discourse.
Android, you know, mobile OS discussion. Wake up. It's time to listen again.
Wake up. Now, I would just like to point one thing out to our beloved listeners. There have been no bleeps for ages.
Oh, really?
When's the last time you heard a bleep? There have even been C-bombs on the show that have gone unbleeped from boys. Because, I mean, I mean, there were the odd little complaints. But, I mean, I'd rather be clean than bleepy.
Yes.
I think that the shine, the comedy of the bleep wore off eventually.
It did. I mean, I think we could probably still hopefully get for another a good redaction.
Yeah.
Because I did enjoy that. We'll see how we go with that.
I've also been trying to cut back a bit on the editing. Oh, God. It takes so much time. You have no idea. It's like a 0.5% improvement on the experience of listening. And it's
so rolling back a tiny bit to that discussion, someone did drop the mention of the tax working group report. No, the savings working group report saying that one of their things was compulsory KiwiSaver, the other was 17.5% GST.
17.5%?
Yeah, more GST. Surely that reminds me of the time when I was a student and they were thinking about student loans. Mm. And the working group came out and said, here's your two options. One is you pay for everything and the other is you pay for some things.
Mm.
And there was no full funding as an option.
Yeah.
And so basically they had the two options there so that one seemed better than the other.
Mm.
I think it's the same thing with this savings working group.
Mm.
They'll keep talking about raising GST and then say, aha, we've only done this.
Yeah.
When we could have raised GST.
The bastards. False dichotomies. Left, right, and centre.
They're taking our holidays away as well.
All right. Let's get on to the rest of the news. The non-Android and iPhone and phone 7 related news.
What other news is there, Morgan?
What have you got? I say, let's have more holidays. You say?
The Prime Minister says, what does he say? I'm relaxed.
I'm very relaxed about the whole thing. And then he smiles and then he waves.
This was about...
And then he drives off to his ivory castle.
And eats cake.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't eat cake. We eat cake, don't we?
We're fat. I imagine he probably eats a lot of gold. It's not very fattening. And he does probably have quite a lot of it.
Through the lower duodenum.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, when Anzac Day falls on a weekend, we don't get any holiday.
Right. It's only a half day anyway, isn't it, for most people?
It's a full day for most people. The thing is, Anzac Day, I think, is sacred because there's only, 2.5 days now in the year where you can guarantee things are going to be closed.
Yeah.
Which I think those days are lovely. They remind me of Sundays.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid.
That's right.
Wasn't Sundays great? You had no choice but to do something.
Go to the beach.
Go to the beach, go climb a mountain, hang out with your family, but now you just keep on going.
I don't know about this climbing a mountain stuff. I'd ride my bicycle to the beach, though. I think kids these days aren't allowed to do that.
So I love Anzac Day because you know that in the morning you're going to go to the dawn parade and that the shops are going to be closed and it's going to be quiet and all that sort of stuff. But the fact is that there are legislated public holidays throughout the year and we don't get some of them because they fall on weekends. Anzac Day and Waitangi Day are two examples, and they both fall on a weekend this year.
Yeah.
And so there's a suggestion that we do what Australia does, which is when Anzac Day is on a Saturday, you go to your dawn parade on Saturday, but you also get Monday off.
Mm.
But now, the PM's response to that is, quote, are we really just saying that we're going to ignore the day and go to any other Monday?
That's utterly wrong. I mean, it would still be the memoriam would still be celebrated on the appropriate day.
Absolutely. It's just that he's totally burying it, you know, with stupid semantics.
But the thing is, and this... actually is courtesy of David Farah from KiwiBlog. He points out that we are in no rush. We're not going to solve this for this year, are we?
No.
No, because that kind of haste and legislation results in, you know, lunacy. And the next time that this comes up, I think, is in 6 years. And then, I mean, and that's for one of them. And the next time one of the others comes up is in like 75 or 85 years or something.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I didn't realize that. So, because it shifted around by leap years.
I think the Anzac Day one comes up 2 in every 7 years, but the other one doesn't come up very often.
I think there's good call then for Anzac Day to be Mondayized. Because yeah. The point I was making on Twitter was that by making it a compulsory long weekend when it falls on a Saturday or Sunday, I think it actually makes people remember it more.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there are sectors of society which would blast through that weekend and forget that it was Anzac Day.
Yeah.
But if there was a Monday holiday, they'd go, that's right. That at least remember it for a moment when it's just like when it's a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
I think also, given that I think it's kind of becoming a de facto national celebration of our individual identity, because it's come to sort of reflect the time we realized that we were being treated like cannon fodder
by
the mother country. Let's have more than one day. Yeah. Let's have a 5-day weekend to celebrate Anzac Day. Let's have the week off. I mean, all New Zealanders of all stripes were present. Actually, not very many women, probably.
No,
probably
true. Well,
not
there
very
were,
many
there
gays.
Were very, significant nurses and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Granted.
Have you heard the history of that stuff? Is it, the one thing that really got me is that the British surveyors basically drove past the headland and drew an outline of it and said, look at that. You know, you just climb up that cliff and you're straight across the top to the Dardanelles or whatever they were trying to get to.
Yeah.
Not with no aerial survey, so they didn't realise that in between those things were three or four or five steep valleys.
Yeah.
So they looked at it in silhouette and said, yep, that's cool. Fuckers.
And what's his name? The chap Mustafa Ataturk, with his famous line, I don't order you to fight, I order you to die. I mean, this is not the sort of commander that you want to come up against.
No, and the thing that I find amazing about that whole Gallipoli thing is that both countries look on it as important.
Yeah. Well, unlike with the battle between the Allies and the Nazis, where the Allies had long, it's fair to say we, isn't it?
I think so.
I mean, yeah. I have no sympathies on the Axis side. The Allies, we had come to hate and revile the Nazis, yeah?
Yes.
I don't think there was any hate of the Turks.
I don't think so. I mean, that's what you read, isn't it?
They were the enemy, but they weren't the hated enemy, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long time ago. We may see things through rose-tinted glasses, but that's the feeling I get. They weren't hated.
Yeah.
And that's why, we sort of get along fairly well even now. I mean, they let us celebrate this, invading their country. They let us celebrate it in their country.
That's amazing. A bit bizarre, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's a bloody good show on their part, actually, I'd say. Talk about dignity. I mean, fair, it's easy to have dignity when you kick our asses. I mean, it's easy to be a good winner. But lots of people are very bad winners and bad losers.
Yes, yes. Ah, dear. So no Monday holiday. We've got to keep working. Fuck it.
Sad face. University gets 1 day more holiday than probably most other people because we get Easter Tuesday. Have you ever had Easter Tuesday?
No.
Nope. And the first time I discovered that was when I drove to work and the car park gate was down and my office was closed and locked. And I was like, what the hell?
It wasn't mentioned when you were unemployed or anything.
And to make it even worse, the next year I went back on Easter Tuesday again. And I was like, oh, I remember this. It's another day off, which I've got nothing planned for. I could have been off somewhere having a holiday, but instead here I am in the office. Unexpectedly sucked in Morgan. Who thinks of Easter Tuesday? It's madness.
Any other news?
Yes, heaps of news. 250, Ben, I didn't know it was this large a number, 250 a year die in domestic mishaps. Did you know it was so many?
No, now, I didn't. It's nearly one a day.
Yeah, and there's a hell of a lot of injuries. That's not really nearly one a day, is it?
3/4 a day.
Yeah. Maybe children. Do children count as a whole one? Or maybe it's old people that don't count as a whole one.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe
how many injuries must there be if there's 250 deaths? According to the Herald article, the social costs of injuries, this is children hurting themselves and elderly people getting hurt while gardening or having falls and so on, the social cost comes to something around $13 billion. So how about instead of selling off our power generation assets, we nerf the whole world, we ban outdoor play, we cover over all the gardens, and maybe we can wrap all of our old people up in bubble wrap. We can ban injuries. All you mothers, children, you're not allowed to play outside anymore. If we see any children climbing trees, there's going to be trouble. Oh, trampolines are now illegal. I'm sorry, yep. Ben. You got to get rid of that thing. It's a death trap. Or maybe a twisted ankle trap. Do you know what? Your son twisting his ankle costs the country, Ben. It's unacceptable. It's worse than drunk driving, Ben.
I think we don't know where you're going with this. I agree that people die.
Yes, people die. We are made of meat. We are animals. And animals die and people die. And we do all sorts of stupid things to ourselves. And that's just the deal. I don't want to die very soon.
It's billions of dollars spent on how to turn out of an intersection campaign. Is it really paying off?
It's the law of diminishing returns. At some point, we just have to say, this is how many people will die. And we can't. And the only thing we can do about it is with the road toll, for instance, as the cars on the road are gradually upgraded to safer cars, that will bring the road toll down.
Yeah, I agree. I
think all of this other social engineering, it has a limit. There's only so much you can do, and then just accidents happen, right? So it rains for the first time after weeks of sunshine. The road is going to be greasy. There'll be more crashes. There's just stuff all that you can do about that.
Absolutely, and there'll be floods, just like, I think that was the point I touched on last show, wasn't it, where I said, we live on a planet and we have stuff.
Yep.
And we're people and we're bags of meat.
There is precipitation. There is physics at play. There is chemistry at play.
So I do think Volvo's got the right angle. Like they have something where they're saying basically they have aimed to have basic, and their new models by 2020 or something, that's what, there will be no deaths worldwide.
Right.
This is their aim.
I love the sound of that.
Maybe 2030 or something like that. But I think it's a good aim, and I think they can get there.
So all we have to wait to happen is for a bunch of wealthy Japanese people to buy those Volvos and then get tired of them and then sell them to us. And then they'll slowly percolate through the system until finally they're on Trade Me for $5,000 and everyone will have one.
And then you'll be safe.
Because, there's a correct term for it, isn't it? Like our... stock.
Fleet's
the word. Jeez, it's such an obvious word. by playing it clean and by not having a whole bunch of caffeine, I've slowed my brain down a little bit, Ben. Our fleet is improving dramatically, but it's still, mainly kind of shitty old Japanese cars.
But isn't that better for the environment? So I
much better for the environment to use an old car than to create a new one, even if it is a relatively inefficient one. But you know what's better for the environment than driving a really efficient new car?
Riding a bike.
Not eating meat. I'm sorry to break it to you. Eating meat.
And also not having a dog. Not having a pet dog, apparently.
If you have a dog, the best thing you can do is eat it. And then compost your poos. Well, the dog already exists, right? So if you eat it, that kind of stops it from... I don't mean have a dog for the purposes of eating it. I mean, you've got to get rid of the dog, and the most efficient thing to do with it, if you're going to top it, you might as well eat it. You can probably enjoy it. I understand from...
You're saving one more meat cow.
No, get rid of the meat cows, because the cows, they take up land, which would otherwise probably be forested. And they also belch out methane. And methane is something like 25 times worse in terms of as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. 25 times worse. And they pour it out. They pour it out constantly because, happens when you digest cellulose...
You break it down, don't you?
You break it down, and one of the things that happens is you produce methane. And so now we have so many cows in New Zealand, so many more than we ever had before. I mean, our sheep stocks are plummeting, but we're building these massive dairy farms in places where they really have no place being, like in the dry Canterbury Plains, and they just pour out methane. It's terrible. It's toxic.
They're going to genetically engineer cows to not belch so much methane, though, aren't they?
It would also be nice to genetically engineer them to every now and then shed steaks. Just drop them off. They could be coated in some kind of bioplastic.
Yep.
And they just drop off and they look delicious and marbled. I would eat the hell out of steaks if you didn't have to kill an animal to get them. And it's got to tickle and make them giggle every time they shed a steak.
Okay, good. Rattle.
It's a happy experience for them.
A couple of other stories in the news this week, and they kind of relate to this. 100 years. Jesus, I've got this
100-year flat. No.
100 projects in 100 days of Les, right. Len Brown.
Les Mills.
Les Brown.
It works.
Les Brown, lesser known brother of Les Mills.
Yep.
He's doing a whole lot of stuff.
Yes.
How much of it do you think is going to actually happen?
Well, I understand that some of the stuff is completely business as usual. It's really, I mean, it's not like new projects. It's, yeah. I will ensure that the sun rises tomorrow. That is
doing so well.
Promise number 90 on my list. I also understand that that they're nowhere near 100. Even using business as usual stuff as new initiatives, they're still nowhere near 100. So
it must be a hell of a struggle.
Yeah, and I mean, kind of just make work. I mean, why?
But there's tiny, tiny things as well. Like my wife, Ellie, has discovered that, you know, of course, because all the libraries are one now, you can order any book you want and say, please bring it to my library.
Yeah.
And so she ordered 20 books for, you know, our son and daughter to read.
Yeah.
And the comment from the librarian when they came in is basically what's happening is they've had to triple or quadruple their courier runs to get these books from Warkworth and Manukau and all over the place. And they're crossing over midstream and books just, you know, they're massively increasing the cost of transferring books.
They need one of those clever salesman algorithms where they kind of maximize the efficiency of where the book is housed.
Or a pneumatic delivery system.
Oh, God, yes.
That would be awesome. Pneumatic pipes under Auckland, between libraries. 150
kilometres of pipes. Shub. Yes. Shub. Shub.
That'd be fantastic.
Harry Potter's in Shub. It's like magic.
But among his other projects, what there was one you mentioned?
There's one I mentioned, and this is on the Herald. It is headlined Queen Street Car Ban Touted by Council.
Now,
and
I would like you, when you report this in the show notes, to link to a blog post of mine from prior to the Super City election with my platform for election.
Yep.
Do you remember that?
I remember it going up. I don't remember all of the details.
One of the details was to pedestrianise Queen Street.
You're a goddamn genius, Ben. You're like some sort of soothsayer. Do I mean
But I did have the requirement for a stream to run down the middle of it at grassy banks.
Right.
So people could walk barefoot down.
Now, you will recall, speaking of grassy banks and streams, last week our guest Lance Wiggs suggested that Hamilton had, you know, one of his favourite main streets. I think it's Victoria Street or something. And I actually, I went down on the weekend to have a look. And, I mean, it's nice. They've killed the two central lanes, so one lane each way has now been replaced by gardens.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
From what I can tell, and lots of pedestrian crossings. Is it particularly great? What it's let down by is the chain of shitty corporate-owned pubs and restaurants that line.
And the fact that it's Hamilton.
It's not a very exciting place. They seem to have an enormous amount of development going on, though. I just didn't feel, I mean, it just didn't feel like it gelled as a wonderful city to me, but the locals seemed to like it.
I suppose it's better than what it was, a lot.
No doubt.
The only other project, Queen Street, and then we can cover that Hero Parade, which is another project of Les Brown's.
Yeah. Now, it's not just what I'm saying about it. According to the City Centre Master Plan, which is a 20-year plan being drafted for public release in March.
That's a good idea.
It is a wonderful idea, and 20 years should only be part of it. They should, I think, also think out 50 and 100 years. I mean, we should plan in 100 years to have a comprehensive subway network throughout the city.
Sure.
And if we know that has to be built in 100 years, we've got to start cracking on it, right?
Yes.
All right. Anyway, the story about this.
And there was an interesting post today by some transport blog that pointed out that even if you did do the through tunnel, you're going to basically screw up the through tunnel under Britomart. You're going to screw up the terminating trains which can't go through, like the overlander.
I think there are.
So there's bigger problems.
I think there are six. Platforms, though.
Platforms.
So you can have two or four going straight through and two terminating. That doesn't seem like a problem. Also, for God's sake, straighten out our rails. Rolling out of Britomart, it's all clunky and jerky.
It's just ridiculous. Even Sydney, It's hideous. Yeah. They just rattle and roll and it's horrendous. Yeah.
Anyway, the plan talks about, well, it moots a few ideas, which maybe it's not serious about, creating a downtown Chinatown, which we used to have once upon a time.
Yeah, true.
I'm not really very excited about that idea. Building public spaces over motorways and providing playgrounds for children, which seems like a good idea.
How does the public spaces over motorways thing work?
I don't know.
I guess that's what filling in
multi-layer things. Is that like, so we get the new tunnel down at Victoria Park there. Are they talking about having a park on top of that? Are they talking about doing the equivalent of that? Or are they talking about putting like a canopy over everything and putting parks on top of that? I love that idea.
You could fill in Spaghetti Junction, which is a big valley, and you'd have a huge park spanning from, you know, K Road to Newton.
And it would make it quiet. Awesome. It would make it quiet for everyone around it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. So the Queen Street proposal... actually, there's a whole lot of things mooted in this report. For instance, the future direction of the port, having continuous waterfront from the Harbour Bridge all the way to St Heliers.
Nice.
How wonderful would that be?
Yes.
But also turning Queen Street into a mall.
A pedestrian mall.
It talks about having several potential points where it would go up to, maybe starting from Lower Queen Street, naturally, up to Merrill Drive. Which seems further than I think is necessary. I think that Victoria Street, actually, just kind of a chunk in the middle.
Yeah.
And maybe take a leaf out of Hamilton's book, and single lane each way for the rest of it. So have a nice, very wide island in the middle, and that makes it much easier for pedestrians to get across as well, because then there's just a single lane to cross.
Yeah, is that going half-assed, though? I mean, wouldn't it be better to do the whole thing?
Well, the super proposal is to have it a pedestrian boulevard, all the way up to Kerang Happy Road.
Wow, that slices the city in half.
It really does, and it means that cars, which are already... it's a bit tricky getting across the city.
Imagine the mayhem on Key Street.
Yeah.
It would just be a total bottleneck, and it would also be horrendous for the waterfront. You'd have to have a couple of streets cutting across, like Victoria and Merrill Drive.
Yeah, and that's why I think Merrill Drive, it should be no higher than Merrill Drive. I think Victoria Street is a more likely upper point.
And it's because it's kind of a natural... Merrill Drive is just asking for a sweat bath anyway.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. So keep the cross streets, and just have parks and the rest of it. Don't mess around, excuse me, there. I almost went dirty, but I saved myself. Also suggests some light rail. Did you look by any chance at the at that proposal that we mentioned last week for the little tram? Did you look at that further?
No, the tram around the Western Viaduct.
At the moment, only the proposal only says it going as far as Britomart, but wouldn't it be lovely to have a tram go up to K Road? Up to K Road, maybe up to Newmarket? And because that's going to be... you know, running and on the surface and good for tourists, and there's no reason it can't work in conjunction with the subway, which will cover, you know, maybe some similar territory if it did go as far as Newmarket. I don't see why it can't.
No, I think it'll be great.
Awesome. Now, what the worst-case scenario is that we get a Christchurch-style tram where it is really just for tourists. It's not for residents.
Well, that's what we've got before the World Cup, isn't it? In time for the World Cup is this stupid little tourist tram around.
It is... Long term, I think it's a stupid idea.
You've been down there recently as well. So seriously,
I haven't seen any of that construction. I haven't been over there. I haven't been over to the tank farm.
Have a look, because that can't be corrected in time for the World Cup. It's impossible. So that tram is just going to be around a wasteland, literally. Okay.
Yeah.
Nuts.
Yeah, I mean, how long does it take to even, you know, grow grass? It takes a couple of months, right? So are they going to lay in turf? I mean, what's happening with the trees? They're going to helicopter some trees in? I mean, what must that soil be like after decades of being full of chemicals?
I tell you what they need to do down there.
Yep.
They need to get the gays in.
Get the gays in?
Get the gays in.
They'll zhuzh the whole place up. It will be all sparkly.
Their pink shorts and their boas and, you know, marching down there.
And their sweaty, rippling abs. Oh, God, Ben. Oh, God. I'm so excited.
I'd be there every lunchtime.
Yep. Certainly would. I'd be having a big sandwich with those boys.
In terms of a segue, I think that works quite well.
Yes, very cleverly done. So we're talking about the suggestion that we bring back the Hero Parade.
Is that one of these 100 projects? Because it should be.
You know what? I think that at the moment, the suggestion is just trying to get Len to consider the idea. I don't think it's one of the 100 projects. This isn't coming from Len. This is coming from the gay community. Well, you know, some members of the gay community who really want the Hero Parade back. And I've got to say, I agree with them. The Hero Parade was a brilliant night.
It was fantastic. I remember it well, you know, going along and hanging out. It was just, It was our only carnival.
Yep. It wasn't like Boobs on Bikes, let me tell you.
Hell no.
Now,
working in the CBD, I ran across it last year. I didn't actually intentionally know it was on. And it really is a sad, disgusting spectacle.
Yeah, I stay far away. I've never actually seen it, but I have watched it on the news, and the spectacle, to me, actually, is all of the sweaty, excited men pitching tents with cameras out.
Exactly.
You know, they're obvious. I don't know what they're planning. They're planning on beating off to pictures of these dirty, you know, second-rate B-list porn stars later on with their breast augmentation scars and
badly framed shots and, you know, bad lighting. And
if you want pornography, you know, there are professionals who make the stuff really well.
And if you want tits, you can kind of get hold of some real ones reasonably easily.
Are you suggesting prostitution or
No, dating, anything. God.
I remember you talking about free boobs once upon a time on Twitter. It was a little bit, I talk about objectifying your wife. I've got free boobs in my house right now. That's not actually her name, Ben. Hey, free boobs, come over here and make me a sandwich.
But it's, I mean, you know, it's... Like you, exactly what you say is it's weird desperation.
Now, this story actually about Hero, let me get you some more facts. I actually got this from Tumeke, which is Bomber Bradbury's... Martin Bradbury? Does he go by the name Bomber?
I think he goes by the name Bomber.
Anyway, I'll call him Martin. And I will avoid Tim Selwyn, who also blogs on Tumeke, because Tim Selwyn, crikey. Now, headline here, Len, isn't it time to bring back the Hero Parade? Now, this is coming hot on the heels of, you know, several pretty horrible hate crimes against gay couples and, you know, long-term, very happy and loving relationships, which apparently small New Zealand, not necessarily living in small towns, because I think one of them happened in Christchurch, small-minded New Zealand, attacking these loving couples.
Where is this coming from?
But The Gay Blade, which is gayblade.blogspot.com, not a site I've ever actually visited. There's a quote from there, though, that talks about the good that comes out of Hero. It makes the gay community visible. It gives them a reason to take pride in being queer. And I'll continue with this quote. Visibility matters, and so does pride. Hero, when at its best and strongest, was inspirational. I doubt we can recreate it. Not sure we should even try. Times have changed, but its underlying message is still right on the money. We need to take pride in ourselves. We need to find ways to pass down to new generations the experience and wisdom we have gained. And yes, we still need to explain that being gay is perfectly normal and nothing to be ashamed of. All right.
I completely agree.
So Len Brown, Hero Parade. Do it.
Put on your list of things. Was there not, though, though was the wrong word.
Yep.
Thinking about the Hero Parade reminds me that was there not some... skepticism and infighting around the parade versus the fundraising versus the night. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do, but I don't remember the details. It's a long time ago now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would say that we don't need to worry about that. We just need to get it right. I would also say that, I mean, now it's not really fair to, you know, moot Hero and then say, don't make it completely gay. But I say, let's celebrate, let's suggest that everyone should be able to take pride in being whatever they are, whatever kind of queer you are, straight, gay, transgender, bisexual, whatever, asexual if you want. I don't know about that. An asexual parade would be very exciting. Hello, I've been to the library. What are you all doing? Would you like to have some tea? I've insulted the asexuals, Ben. That's a powerful group. Good evening. No, it's actually past my bedtime.
The wife beaters and rapists should also have a parade.
Certainly not.
He's right.
I don't think abusers should be proud. I think that, you know, all of, you know, the rest of us.
Healthy sexuality.
Yep. And, you know, acknowledging that there's all kinds of things are healthy. Now, you know, actual abuse is not healthy, but, you know, there's bondage, which might seem on the outside to have, you know, some similar characteristics to abuse, but it's not because it's consent.
Yeah, and that was one of the complaints about the parade, isn't it? That they did have some light bondage in the parade.
Yeah, I love that. And I seem to recall, like, maybe was there like an angle grinder shooting off sparks and people strapped down in black leather and ball gags? And lots of girls, some who I know were definitely not lesbians because at least one of them went to my school and I'm pretty sure she wasn't gay, you know, painted up, all topless and painted up in fun party colours and rocking out in little shiny hot pants.
You know what will happen though?
Yep.
The naysayers will come out, like the woman that commented, there was a review of the Laneways Festival in the Herald and the second comment was, oh yes, Len loved that so much, but he didn't love us poor people in our apartments with this screeching, horrible noise going on for so long.
I could hear it. It sounded all right.
Yeah.
From my apartment.
And would I say correctly?
If you live in the city.
Yeah, exactly. You live in the CBD, you would expect there to be parties and stuff.
This is like the crybabies who moved in next to Temple and were like, it's noisy living next to a nightclub. No one warned me. You retard.
Didn't Laneways finish at like 10 p.m. or something?
I don't actually know what time it finished. I didn't go to Laneways.
It went on to one of them.
My baby sister, 15 years old, was very excited about the people playing. So I thought, okay, well, I mean, if she's excited and if I know the kind of music she likes, then probably I'm not that excited. I've got a few friends who went and really enjoyed it. So probably that was, you know just my prejudice getting in the way of a good time.
But obviously it was too loud.
Too loud. Nimbies. It's too loud.
Concerned of CBD.
Yeah. Now, I mean, fair enough. Sound can actually be quite frustrating, but there are kinds of sound which are just live with it.
Yeah, I mean, I did that shit, and it worked sadly.
Yeah,
sadly on Laneways, and I came down to get in my car, and it was echoing around pretty madly, and I couldn't understand what was going on because of the amount of echoing. But I knew it was Laneways, and I knew it was people having fun.
Your fireworks, well, you're celebrating the city's foundation. Your fireworks make banging noises in the sky, and the banging's going to go along for at least 5 minutes in the evening. This is unacceptable. Why are all you hundreds of thousands of people having fun?
The quote in the article was, noise control came knocking. Thankfully, nothing came of it, which may have something to do with Len Brown in the audience. And her response is, what a hypocrite. Brown said he'd be the mayor for all Aucklanders. When we want a peace and a reduction and an end to the demented screeching that echoed around the apartments and buildings for over 10 hours, where was the mayor?
What do you mean, we, lady? Who are you speaking for? You're not speaking for me. I'm going to say, we want more concerts in the city. And I am only saying it that way because I'm having a clean show, you lovely woman.
It goes on, when will Len Brown learn that this is not his city? It is also home to many more people than him and his entourage.
A what? What a nutter. Excuse me, alleged nutter.
Total.
Alleged moonbat.
Diana of Auckland CBD, I salute you for your moonbatness, allegedly.
Now, good for her having her say. But I hope no one listens, because no, that wasn't bad. I mean,
for once in the New Zealand Herald, your views, the dissenting view was clear.
Right. If it had been going at 3 a.m., that is a different matter, right?
But she said it went on for 10 hours. I know it started about midday, so.
Yeah, 10 p.m. is definitely not too late. 10 p.m. is just
sad. She could have just gone out, for God's sake.
Yeah, go out, lady. No, but there's people everywhere, don't you know? That frightened me. That frightened me something awful. The world is full of madness. Some cars are red. Why do some people think they can have red cars? Why won't the government do something about it? They're very noisy on my eyeballs. The colour red, it excites my retinas. Makes me feel a little bit hungry and like having a wee or touching myself on my front bone.
We'll take care of it by selling the dams.
Let's not sell the dams. I say no. I say that the dams that we built with our back-breaking labour.
And our own money.
Look at me. I'm a programmer and I edit a podcast and I'm talking about back-breaking labour.
We should quickly do corrections while we're waiting to talk like an Egyptian.
Corrections. Actually, I think there's probably some good corrections.
There's one correction from me quite clearly where those Dell tablets I said were cool last week.
Yeah.
The Dell Streak 7. The thing is, I went to the PR thingy and they weren't turned on. And so we got to handle them.
A what?
Well, the Dell Streak 5 was turned on, and that was kind of fun to play with, but the Streak 7 wasn't turned on because it was a production sample. But it looked nice. It was nice to handle and stuff.
Yeah.
But Engadget actually reviewed them and said, in conclusion, when you combine its low-resolution screen, poor battery life, and soon-to-be-outdated OS, we simply can't recommend it, even if it doesn't break the bank. So not so much.
I read something. Where today? Was it on Crunch Gear? That says it's not rubbish. Let's see. What do they have to say?
That's funny.
Another impressive 7-inch Android tablet with Gorilla Glass screen, 4G networking, and a suave interface. Is this thing more of the same or something new? The tried and true 7-inch tablet by now old hat. In fact, little about the Dell Streak is new except the clear emphasis on media playback and T-Mobile's 4G wireless. On the aggregate, I'd say that this is a strong showing for Dell.
Wow. There was the same, I think the same
thing. Hey, wait a second. I'm sorry. I have to interrupt. There's a photo of this Dell on his bookcase. The only book that I can read in the background is Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. So fuck this guy. Oh my God, I blew it. Oh no, I went dirty. Oh.
I'm sorry. There is times to swear.
Oh, I'm sorry, listeners. I didn't even, I couldn't make it for one show without swearing. I'm so disappointed. But I would say 800 by 480 screen. 7-inch, it's pretty low. Because, I mean, an 800 by 480, that's the resolution of my two lower resolution netbook, my first-gen netbook. Yeah. I think that was a 7-inch screen, and that thing's like 3 or 4 years old.
Fuzzy as all get out.
Yeah, so I don't think this is, I don't know, it doesn't really impress me. It looks all right.
The funny thing is the same thing happened with the Samsung Galaxy Tab. Gizmodo panned it. Yeah. Crunch Gear loved it, and Engadget loved it.
I mean, this is only the opening paragraph of a review, right, with many other paragraphs where possibly it turns out that this thing is a piece of junk. Oh, it does say that there's a problem with the button placement. They don't like the orders. It's non-standard.
Any other corrections?
Yes, there are other corrections. For one thing, I spoke over Lance when he was talking about... what's the site?
All about the story.
Now, I spoke over him. I'm sure that he was about to disclose that he has some stake in that. But I spoke over him before he could finish.
Oh, okay.
So there was no disclosure of that. So I apologize for that.
The other correction was that I didn't realize when making fun of Peter Thiel as a mad libertarian that he is, that, and I was asking Lance over and over again what he'd invested in New Zealand. One of them was Xero. And then I found out the next day the other one was Pacific Fibre. Which is kind of funny.
Brilliant. Yeah, he seems like a really fascinating character. And
yeah, he's got a lot of money, and yeah, it's...
and he's made a lot of amazingly sound investments.
Facebook, what else? Well, I mean, PayPal.
Yeah, PayPal is a pretty big one.
All sorts of crazy
stuff. Yeah, but a whole lot. Yeah. I mean, I'd say that Tesla's going to pay off.
Yeah.
Especially now that they've got some kind of technology sharing arrangement with Toyota, I think it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
Now, I would also like to apologize for talking over people a little bit too much last week. Once again, I was high on the Monster, and I love the Monster. I wish that Monster had a bigger profile in New Zealand so we could suggest they sponsor the show, because of all the products we've ever spoken about, that's the only one I've been completely glowing about. It is so delicious, and it really does the job.
We also need to get, you did talk over one spot which I had feedback on from three different people, was that Lance was about to talk about the business model behind Groupie.
Yeah.
And I we'll have to get
and I talked over that.
That is.
Are you sure?
Yeah. What's that?
I don't remember that. That might be true.
No, the pizza interrupted.
Ah, I see. Well, that's not me talking over him, is it?
No. But anyway, the biggest news of the week, we've talked about asset sales, and I think...
I'm actually a little bit afraid about this story because it is so important to so many people that I don't want to get it wrong.
No, absolutely not. And I don't really want to talk about it.
This is Egypt. This is what seems like a revolution, really.
Yeah, can't really put it any other way. So again, we don't want to talk about it without thinking about people that have, I guess, a knowledge of what's going on.
Yeah.
So it's been very nice for a guy who works at the company I work at, Hadi Osman, hopefully got your name right, who I'm going to call, you're a Kiwi of Egyptian descent, would you say, Hadi?
Yeah, I guess. I've been in the country for about 14 years now.
We've got a guest on Discourse.
And you have family in Egypt as well.
Most of my family is in Egypt at the moment, yeah.
I hope that they're safe.
Okay, so...
They're safe at the moment, yes.
Okay. So I guess how do we introduce this? But basically, everyone knows what's going on in Egypt. And I mean, Hardy, what's your view on it? What is happening?
Maybe everyone doesn't know. I would say that I mean, one thing we say that Egypt has been living under a dictatorship for the last 30 years. Yeah, with faux democracy. Do they actually have elections?
Yeah, that's the thing. So, you know, they do have elections, but they're well known to be rigged since Mubarak has come into the regime. And the system that Egypt has is basically the same system that all countries in the Middle East have. So all the presidents are pretty much from the military.
Mm.
So if you look at Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, and Egypt and Syria, all the presidents are from the military. They're all military men. And they've all been in power for 25 and 30 years, and they all sort of plan to pass their power on to their sons or people in the family.
Right.
That's happened in Syria. It was planned to happen in Egypt, for people that know the politics in Egypt. So everybody's got pretty much the same system. And what happened this year, or pretty much the end of last year, is Tunisia. If people remember back to Tunisia, there were a lot of protests that happened there.
That was the, what was it, the... Not Velvet Revolution.
Yeah, I think it got given that nickname. What? So what actually happened over there is there again, Tunisia again has got the same problems of Egypt, probably on a smaller scale. So they've got more educated people. Their economy is not doing too bad. You know, it's a small country. Yeah. Egypt is 80 million. Tunisia, I think we're talking about 2 or 3.
Right.
So it's a much smaller country. So what's happened? There was a person there who was a graduate from one of the universities in Tunisia. Couldn't find a job, unemployed, no hope. So what he did is he got a little stall in the street and he was selling fruit.
Yeah.
The council came in and they pretty much told him what you're doing is illegal, and they've closed down his own source of income for his family and you know, and himself. So frustrated, not just because of that, but because of many, many things. He ended up covering himself in petrol. So he drenched himself in petrol. And he put himself on fire in front of the parliament in Tunisia. And
Jesus.
Yeah. So as a result, that particular incident, people started rioting in Tunisia slowly. I've got a Tunisian friend who was telling me he's got family in other areas of Tunisia that never heard of this incident until 3 days later. So it tells you the control that these countries have on the news, on the radio, and on the media. So nobody heard of such an incident until 3 days later in most of Tunisia.
Right, and it's not that large a country, right?
It's not that large a country, no. But what happened is people started rioting and going in protests, and people started joining these protests, and pretty much you had most of the country down on the streets. And just things started escalating, police couldn't control things, and in the end, I think what really was the defining moment is the army in Tunisia told the president that it's his time to go.
Right.
And he basically fled. He tried to go to France initially, and they refused him. He tried to go to Dubai, and they refused. And he's now in Saudi Arabia. So
these military leaderships around, you know, dictatorships, you know, like you mentioned Syria, Egypt, all these things, are they? Is it like the situation in? I know they're completely unrelated, but Afghanistan, where basically the Taliban were installed by the United States. Do you know if that's the same situation?
I think in Egypt it's along those lines. I think Egypt has the greatest U.S. military support. I think they support Egypt more than they support Israel.
No,
in terms of cash that they provide.
No way.
You don't think so?
Israel always has to be number one. So the relationship of the United States and the West with Egypt is very, very important. So
yeah.
Egypt is probably the biggest player in the Middle East. So Egypt to the Middle East is what the U.S. is to the world. So everybody looks up to the U.S. in terms of, you know, the politics, art, education, entertainment. Egypt is pretty much the same thing.
Mm.
If Egypt is not stable, the whole region becomes destabilized. And that's why Egypt is a very important player. And like you said, Egypt is actually the second recipient of aid after Israel. So I think Egypt receives $1.5 billion every year.
Yeah.
Israel is about $3 billion at the moment every year.
So I imagine what will be happening right now is massive diplomatic work to get a US-friendly replacement in place?
Exactly. That's the thing. And that's where... A lot of us, you know, especially Arabs or Muslims living in the Western world, I mean, we value the values that we have here in terms of democracy, freedom of speech, but we see a lot of hypocrisy in terms of how the Western countries deal with the Middle East. So the people in Egypt at the moment what they're doing is a democratic revolution. They're there to say that we've had enough of the rotten, incompetent puppet presidents and dictators. They want to have a voice. They want to be able to really vote for who leads them. But then on the other hand, the US is in a position where they can't just leave people to go and vote for who they want. So if you look at who's got proper elections in the Middle East, I reckon nobody's got proper elections except what we saw in Palestine.
Right.
Where the people actually did or had free elections. But what happened is the people ended up voting for the wrong party.
Right.
And as a result, that party or that particular region got isolated and starved. And I'm talking here about Gaza, and the west of Palestine. So there's no really free or true elections in the Arab world. And the reasons is you can't really have that. You can't really take a risk in having a democratically elected person who is not playing the same tune as what the United States are after.
That sucks. I can't even think of any other way to put it, but fuck.
Robert Fisk has described the situation as the death throes of a dictatorship. And just an interesting point, China have blocked the word Egypt.
The kind of likely candidates, the Muslim Brotherhood is being pushed around as behind some of this revolution stuff. Now, I don't know how to put this.
What
because
is
I know
the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, this is they're a loose organization. There's a good Wikipedia article on them. I don't know how balanced it is. But the thing is, I don't know how to place this question. I don't know if you can help, Haiti. But because I know Christianity is just as has its freaks and geeks as well. But are the Muslim Brotherhood, do they have Egypt's interest at heart and this sort of stuff?
Okay. So the Muslim Brotherhood, again, is another group that started in the 1920s. Okay.
Yep.
They've definitely denounced violence 50 years ago. So they are a politically involved party. And they've got a lot of the Islamic principles as their basis. Now, I'm neither for them or against them. They are sort of a polarized group. But they definitely have the most amount of support in Egypt at the moment. Now, the interesting thing that I'd like to highlight is, whenever you read about the Muslim Brotherhood, they'll always say the banned party but tolerated, or the banned party but that's still running, which it doesn't really make sense. How is a party that's banned still operating in the parliament and, in day-to-day basis?
Yes.
What the regime is actually doing is as follows. They want the Muslim Brotherhood to stay and continue, okay? And what they do is they go and shut down all other opposition. So there was liberal oppositions like Ayman Nour, for example, who was imprisoned again with rigid reasons, and he was imprisoned for forgery for a couple of years. And he's a person that you could say is a secular or a liberalist. But the Muslim Brotherhood is allowed to continue. And what the regime comes and does is it says, look, they are the alternative here. And they play again on the word Muslim or Islamist and so on to basically give you the impression that if you're not getting us, okay, you're going to get the Taliban or bin Laden's, for example.
It's like the scare factor with the West.
It's a scare factor, although I'd probably say that they are a progressive Islamic party, just like what you have in Turkey at the moment. So if you look at the government in Turkey, it is an Islamic government, but you could say it's a progressive Islamic government at the moment that's running in Turkey. So again, I'm neither for them or against them, but just want to highlight how the Egyptian regime is actually using the fear factor for their benefit. And that's why they like them to be around, and they like to highlight them all the time.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, the whole Islamic thing does my nut as well, because you basically say, well, look, the US has a Christian government, and look where that's got us. So there's nothing to be worried about, I hate the way that it's used as a pejorative term. Bizarre.
I mean, I was just talking to a friend today about this, and I told him, one of the downsides of the tyranny and the dictatorship they have in Egypt is the normal Egyptian person is finishing university or, can't go to university. He's not able to get a job. He's not able to get married. He feels there's no hope. He's humiliated every day from the police or from old incidents in the streets. So he ends up trying to look for a way to vent out. So some are stuck in the world of drugs and alcohol and whatever, makes them forget what happens. And some people turn to religion. Now, when you have an education system like, you know, what you have in Egypt, which is very dismal at the moment, it's one of the worst educational systems now. Unfortunately, it used to be one of the best in the Middle East. But you've got people with no religious education all of a sudden turning with a lot of energy and a lot of passion towards religion because they're trying to find a way out or a way to vent out. And that's the perfect candidate that you have to sort of take, brainwash, and you sort of slowly coach him into extremism and eventually into violent extremism. So,
well, I mean,
the fight you get, or, you know, the reasons why you get a lot of wackos at the moment in the Middle East is because of the system they have, the oppressive system that you have, which doesn't allow for people to represent themselves or vent out.
Yeah. Funny thing is the same thing is going to happen in the States with more Timothy McVeighs that they're producing right now, I imagine. Don't you think? I mean, the way the poverty line's going there as well. But anyway, back to Egypt. So your family is safe?
Yep. We've struggled to ring them. So even though the phone lines are slowly coming back, you're not always able to connect to them. So we've spoken to them. Everybody's safe. Everybody's quite anxious at what's happening. So even though people are afraid, there are a lot of positive things coming out. So a lot of us have sort of given up on the country. We've seen, so because of the regime, the Egyptian people themselves have slowly changed. You know, they're not the hospitable people that they used to be. But the protests that have just been happening over the last week has surprised many of us. We've got Egyptians who are very, very civilized. A lot of people went around the museum while they're protesting, and they made a wall there to protect the museum from any looting, from any gangs.
It's a very powerful photo that I've seen, anyway, of basically a human shield around the museum.
Extremely, especially if you know what the state of the country is. You've got a lot of youth who are growing up, seeing that there's no hope in the country, seeing the corruption around them. They've got no reason to relate to the country, and all of them are thinking, how do we get out? How do we go to Europe? How do we go to other countries? And that was never the mindset of an Egyptian. So now you've got kids as young as 15 years old helping out in what you have, the neighborhood watches that were made now that the police is out, trying to protect their building or the neighborhood that they're in. So just these small things, you know, so basically people have united on a common purpose, which is downing Mubarak and ending his time once and for all. So speaking to my family, so, you know, there's a lot of positives. They are definitely getting worried, but everybody's hopeful that it's going to be a phase, that's going to be over, and it is to the best as well.
Yeah. So do you think the natural progression seems to be, I mean, some Mubarak has sacked his entire government and installed what is his security chief as a prime minister.
Yeah.
But that's not going to hold, right? People aren't going to accept that.
The US have said that they don't recognize the government, the new government.
Yeah, well, the US just last week, I think Hillary Clinton was saying that the Egyptian government is stable. Joe Biden, the vice president, said that Egypt has taken relative to normalizing relationship with Israel and therefore he doesn't refer to Mubarak as a dictator. Mm. So the US at the moment is, to be honest, they haven't really taken a stance, just like they never took a stance with Tunisia until Ben Ali was sort of taken out. Mm. I read an interesting article today, which was actually a US report saying that Mubarak knows that his time is out, but he doesn't want to run away like a criminal. Mm. And apparently he's in talks with the army at the moment that when things calm down, he's going to go and resign with dignity. So that is one scenario that's being played, that everybody is currently, that, you know, he's sort of vetting the government at the moment, getting ready to leave the people that he wants and the people that the US are happy with, and that he's eventually going to leave after things calm down. Now, today, as we speak, in the next 2 hours, there's another protest that is starting. It's called the Million Protest, where they're trying to get over 1 million people down on the streets. Now, this is really a decisive moment because if the army is not able to control the people tonight, then that plan, you know, allowing for things to stabilize and calm down, for Mubarak to resign gracefully, might not hold, and Mubarak might have to take a hike a bit earlier than what he expected.
Now, is it correct that the army are actually really keeping the peace at the moment? The police force have shot at protesters and attacked protesters, but the army seems to be behaving actually with a lot of restraint. And one video I've seen, it was hard to evaluate exactly what was happening, saw a bunch of unarmed soldiers on foot and armoured personnel carriers lining up in front of protesters, and it seemed like they were protecting them from a very large group of armed police.
Yeah.
Also, the army has said today that they recognise, quote, the legitimacy of the people's demands. And they've also said, well, a military spokesman has said, that they have not and will not use force against the public.
Exactly, which is a bit of a blow for Mubarak, because this means that they're not going to go and try and suppress the protests immediately. Mm-hmm. I think there's a very important distinction between the police and the army in Egypt.
Yeah.
The police has always been seen as a regime or as an oppressive power used by the regime.
Mm.
And they're very, very much hated. I can tell you many stories of torture that's happened in police stations. So people really, really are upset and hate the police. Mm. The army, on the other hand, historically has always been with the people.
Yeah.
So even when Egypt lost the war against Israel during Abdel Nasser's time, General Abdel Nasser, the people really didn't give much slack to the army, and they were very, very patient with them until the 1973 war came in, and Egypt was victorious in that war, or that's one view of it. So the relationship between the people and the army has always been very, very positive. And what happened actually when the army first came out 2 days ago, the people, the protesters, started greeting them with flowers and hugs, and you know, we saw I saw some weird videos where people are actually going on tanks with army men, you know, taking photos with them. So, you know, it's something that's giving me a bit of comfort at the moment, the relationship between the army and the protesters.
Yeah I thought it was quite revealing. I mean, it's very hard to tell as a complete outsider. I've never even visited Egypt as a tourist, but when you see hundreds of black clad police heavily armed in a bunch, and then you see the crowd with unarmed soldiers freely circulating amongst them, you can see, I think, that the protesters are not afraid of and they're not antagonized against the
and at the same time very respectful of the army, because all you need is just one idiot basically to start shooting at one of them, and you know, you've got an all-out war basically happening on the streets. I think people are recognizing that the Egyptian government now is getting very, very desperate, and everybody's just being as patient and respectful as possible. And signs of desperation, I've just gotten a text message, you know, about an hour ago saying that Egypt or the Egyptian government has blocked all mobile communications again.
Right.
So they basically had mobile communications back 2 days ago, and now all of them are blocked. The internet is still completely shut down.
Which is incredible that no country has ever done that before.
It's incredible. I mean, you know, most governments or most countries have an internet economy, and to think that, you know, taking a risk where you will actually go. Sorry, that's the call for the other my machine.
Do you need to go, Hattie? Or...
we can take a break if you want.
No, that's it's all good. We've got time for that. Right. Thinking that a country can actually go and shut down the internet completely, and they've got an internet economy there, is just unthinkable, to be honest.
Yeah.
But again, just shows you the desperation of the government and the state they're in.
So you're saying the ideal progression from here would be that the Million March, or the Million Protest, comes off tonight, basically shows up that the government has no control, and Mubarak is forced to leave in the next week or so. I mean, what's the alternative?
I think it really comes down to the army. It really comes down to people around Mubarak, whether they're patient with them or not. I think if the army sees that things are going out of control, because if you don't have a million people in the street, you can't really do much. With, you know, what can you do against a million people in the street? You can't shoot them, and at the same time, you can't either suppress them or stop them. So what we're really betting on is somebody in the army, you know, whether they're at the senior ranks or in the middle ranks, to sort of try and slowly pull out their support for the regime. So we're not really sure, to be honest. We're just all hoping for the best. We're also hoping that there's not a lot of bloodshed. I guess historically you have to have bloodshed for a revolution to go through successfully. So it's very, very tense times. So, I mean, most Egyptians have been sleeping at 5 o'clock in the morning on the long weekend that just went by. You know, everyone's just watching the news, waiting anxiously to see the developments.
Well, I hope your family stays safe. I hope that we see the regime toppled peacefully, and you know what I think of as you know a more open, free democracy.
I really hope so. One thing I also like to add is something that really ticked off a lot of the Egyptians living in New Zealand is seeing John Key on the breakfast show. I think it was yesterday morning, where he publicly declared support for Mubarak.
And yeah, he was asked straight up, wasn't he? The presenter said, do you think Mubarak should go? And he just said no.
No, yeah. And his is because of Israel. You know, he said that Egypt has brought peace to Israel and it's respected the alliance with Israel, and that's a good enough reason for him to remain. And it just shocked me. I mean, you know, is John Key's interests the New Zealand values and beliefs that we all believe in and we all live in? I mean, the freedom that we have, the freedom of democracy. I mean, these are things that we're proud of. Why can't we, you know, accept that for other people? Since when is Israel's interests ahead of New Zealand's values and beliefs? I mean, if that's the case, how come we're making a big fuss about, you know, Frank Bainimarama, you know, coming and watching a rugby game in the World Cup?
I think that our values do not support or should not support dictators. And we should value open, free democracy. I think it seems like a really easy decision. I mean, supporting Israel and wanting to be rid of another of the world's dictators, they are not mutually exclusive.
Exactly. Mubarak is not Egypt. You know, Egypt is the people. So if Mubarak goes, you'll still have people there that you can still work with. But, you know, that's what the regime is selling. And unfortunately, a lot of people are buying into it, including our prime minister.
Yeah, not a very smart move on his part, I think.
No. Yeah, well, you know, elections are coming ahead this year, so I know who I'm voting for.
And you can vote, which is more than you can say for your family, which you know, says a
or
lot.
Or at least your vote will be counted.
Yeah, jeez. Well, Hardy, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I'd like to thank you as well for giving me time and, you know, voicing our concerns as well.
Top stuff. Yeah, and thank you very much, and I'll catch you at work.
Awesome, man. Cheers.
Cheers, Hattie.
Cheers.
See ya.
Guys, cheers. Good luck.
Oh, I cut him off just as he was saying good luck.
That's all right.
Yeah, thanks. Fuck. Thanks once again. What it really is illuminating talking to someone who really has an understanding of what's going on the ground. And
Could you imagine having close family members in that situation?
It's a terrible worry. Yeah, it's a really terrible worry. I hope that, I mean, it has been relatively peaceful.
Yes.
I mean, it has been nowhere near as bad as, you know, it could get, right? So yeah. I hope that it stays as peaceful as it is. I hope that the army keeps things under control and you know, keeps everyone cool. Because, you know, a peaceful revolution, a relatively peaceful revolution is a good thing. It's the best sort. Mm.
The point earlier on is the worry is that regardless of the result of the revolution, do you think the US would allow any result?
I don't think that any new government would say no to the US support. I probably shouldn't talk out of a hole in my head when I really don't know about the political scene in Egypt. Now, ideally, of course, is not having a revolution at all. Ideally is having the votes counted and having it sorted out democratically. But if a regime is so corrupted and powerful that it, you know, can do what it likes around elections, what is the alternative? What do you do? I mean, peaceful
revolution.
Protest.
It's what the humans do.
That's right. Okay, so there's a couple of things we've got to get out of the way. Please tell a friend about the show. You know it's good or you wouldn't have listened this far through the show. Right? Did you hear the caliber of guests we've just had on the show? Where else do
it
you
only
get
gets
that?
Better.
Where else do you get that on the internet? Right? That kind of a melange of ideas. Yeah?
And Kiwi focus.
This is not an echo chamber. Yeah? We are broad in our tastes and our likes. So please tell a friend. Tell a friend to listen. Help us out. It's good for us if we have more listeners. Second thing, still only hypothetical because we still haven't got a confirmation on our venue. this live in Wellington on a stage show is...
on Saturday afternoon, February the 19th.
February the 19th. Saturday afternoon sometime because I think, Ben, are you going to come to WordPress camp, WordCamp or whatever?
I may not, depending on when. I mean, depending on
it's going to be tricky timing.
Yep.
Ben, by himself, or us together, maybe speaking at WordCamp about, you know, how we get the podcast together and use WordPress as part of our gestating podcasting empire. Yep. So trying to find a way to fit everything in on the Saturday that, that needs to go there is going to be very tricky.
But tell us if you want us to do it, because if you tell us you're desperate to see us live in Wellington on February 19th, then bloody hell we'll do it.
Tell us if you will come to the show, because if you will come to the show, then it's worth doing. If no one comes, then why why do it live? Why do go to the incredible trouble that it will be? I mean, it would be really cool to do it. I'm not saying it'll be trouble as an excuse to not do it, because I think it will be super ace. So but it's only ace if there's lots of people there.
So if you're coming, tell us either via Twitter, Discourse at DiscourseNZ.
Or comments at discourse.co.nz. Send us an email. Why not?
Yes.
Or go to the Talkback page on discourse.co.nz.
Talkback page yet, but you never use that.
So yeah, I've never used that. And once again, beloved listeners, thanks to our guests and thanks to you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for listening. And I got a hell of a lot out of this show, so even if you don't listen to it, it's great.
And we'll see you again next week.
Night-night.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the weekly show on
Whiskers. Sorry, we're using that one.